Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. This week, we're going to talk about Bloodbath, that whole thing. And we're going to talk about stuff on the campaign trail. We're going to talk about Mike Pence refusing to endorse Donald Trump, at least for now, right? Although I kind of think he's going to hold out, but, you know, we'll see on that. And then we're even going to get into Benjamin Netanyahu. He's addressing Senate Republicans today, and there's even some chatter from the House of Representatives that they might try to do kind of a repeat of that 2015 thing where they invited him to, you know, address a joint session of Congress. Might not be joint since, like, Republicans only control the House. But before we get to all that, I want to share something with you, something very important. And that is that yesterday we kicked off our annual membership drive at TPM. We have two kind of events like this a year. One of them is our membership drive, and it is really important. Now, sometimes, you know, you hear things like this and someone says, oh, you know, if this doesn't happen, we're closing up shop and it's a crisis and all. It's not a crisis, but this is how we run our organization. We run it with membership fees. Just over 90% of the revenue that runs the whole company comes from members, from you. So it is really important to just the whole way that our organization works. And so this is, you know, we have all the different things we do through the course of the year, getting people to sign up, making sure people, you know, continue their subscription. But we rely on an infusion this time of the year during our drive. So it is really important. And what I want to ask you is that, you know, I think probably that we don't really know, podcasts don't work the way that our website does. So we don't really know how many of the listeners of the podcast are members. We assume that just in the nature of things, probably most of you are, but certainly not all of you. And we're not going to be putting it behind a paywall or anything like that, but it is the organization, Talking Points Memo, TPM, that makes this possible. So if you really like the podcast, and even if you don't, you know, even if you don't really go to the site, consider joining. It's not a lot of money. It makes what we do possible. And there's all sorts of great things about the organization. You know, our publisher, I used to be publisher, but I was like kicked upstairs. We have our publisher is this guy, Joe Ragazzo, who I can kind of take credit for all the good stuff he does since I trained him, but we don't have to get into that. Anyway, he shared with me this statistic that 74% of our expenses are for salaries and benefits. So that gives you a sense of how the organization is run, right? The money from your membership fees goes to the people who are actually writing the stuff that you read, or it goes to the people who are actually making the podcast. We're not part of some big corporation where, you know, who knows how that stuff runs. It's going to sort of, you know, debt derivatives, and it's going to, I don't know, all sorts of other things that happen in corporations. It's going to the people who run the shop. So we put it to good use. We break all sorts of news. We have these great reporters. And this is what makes it possible. So if you're not a member, I really hope you will consider joining us. It's money well spent. It helps us do what we do. We are trying to sign up 1,000 new members during this drive. I think when I looked this morning, we were, getting up towards 150. So, you know, we're off to a good start. If you want to join, go to talkingpointsmemo.com and you will instantly see a little, some little doodads and little ads for our drive. Click through and you can join. It's really easy. So that's my spiel. Not even going to do the kind of the monologue thing. Kate, are you pumped about the drive? Your thoughts?
I mean, it really does feel like it's coming at such an inflection point in the industry. You know, we've all been discussing kind of internally and everyone in the business has been talking about it, but I can't remember a period of bloodletting as aggressive as the one we've seen in journalism in the past few months. You know, I mean, layoffs, but also entire outlets just shuttering, you know, websites being pulled down with like 12 hours of, heads up. And the only reason that we've been able to weather those storms are because of the loyalty of our members and who, re-up year after year and kind of help us be a little more insulated from those headwinds that are bringing down other, good independent outlets. And I would just say none of us want to live in a world where the only way that you keep a media outfit afloat is from the largesse of a billionaire, So we just really appreciate all of your support and we do need it to survive. You know, your dollars go a lot longer with us than they might do some of the more, corporately owned outfits. So, appreciate giving what you can. And as always, appreciate you all listening and reading. Our members have always been kind of the lifeblood of our organization.
I mean, the one final thing I will say on this is the great thing about the membership model is that, we have a relationship with you, our members. Now I'm talking to probably the majority of the people who are listening now who are members. And as long as that relationship stays intact, the trends in the industry kind of don't matter, right? We don't care. Who cares what's going on in this trend and that trend? As long as that relationship is intact, then you can have the platforms doing this and all, kind of everything under the sun. And we're still good to go. And that was, when we first started, kind of setting up a membership system, I remember I sent out a memo to staff kind of at the beginning, why we're doing it, blah, 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 blah. And I said, it was something like this, but I kind of put it in a slightly different way, which was that, with advertisers, and we used to sell lots of advertising. I kind of strategized it. It was great. We brought in money, blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, the people who advertised with us didn't care anything about us. And really, that's how you would want it to be, right? You wouldn't want it to be sort of like a cushy, best friends kind of relationship because you don't want to have that kind of dependence. But in that case, you don't know what advertisers are going to want year after year. You don't know what kind of content they're going to want their ads to show up against. You don't know what, maybe the new thing is podcasts or it's video or something like this. But in the membership system, what really matters is, what we are going to be judged on is how good a TPM we are producing, as opposed to kind of like, we don't know what they want. It's like, those things with like the experiments where they kind of take mice and they just kind of like fuck with them constantly, give them food at random times and everything. And they go insane and they get sick and die because they're not in, they have no control over their fate. And at least in the membership system, what do you need to do? Well, what you need to do is be a good TPM. And that at least, it's not guaranteed we can do that, but we should have an inside track on that one, right? We should have some sense of how to do that and some relationship between kind of like our efforts and the results. So all that good stuff. If you've ever considered becoming a member, maybe you were a member and your membership lapsed, please take a moment and join again. So thanks. And you know, thanks for indulging us in a little membership promotion commentary. So now let's get into it. So Kate, where are we on Bloodbath Discourse at this moment? Where do you think we are?
So it's funny because there was this concern that we had specifically right after, I think it was Iowa, where Trump was doing the kind of gracious, normal politician thing for like a second. And then that was a bit compounded by the fact that he never got nailed down on anything during the primary. You know, like his big lead kind of helped him just float above everyone to some degree. You know, it made him look kind of like the big tough front runner who was kind of hitting every contest out of the park, notwithstanding what we've talked about with the, you know, perhaps warning signs embedded in those numbers. But now that we're in the general, he's A, saying crazy things every week, and B, I think they're already getting covered in a way that they weren't before because, you know, and this is a point that I'm cribbing from Dan Pfeiffer, but he wrote in his message box, which I thought was such a good point, that the kind of mainstream media apparatus like only cares in terms of horse race stuff, right? Like that's the only way that they cover Trump's craziness is in the context of will that hurt his electoral prospects and never, you know, will that hurt our democracy, right? Which
or is it bad? Or is it just bad he said it?
Right. But now that it's a general, his crazy stuff is getting covered because those comments might be exactly what the kind of like hardcore Republicans who decide primary winners want, but it's much less what a general electorate is going to want. So he's saying the batshit stuff that he always says. Like, I don't think this went away during the period we weren't hearing about it, but now it's just, it's got a longer shelf life. And the big one from over the weekend were these comments he made, where was this kind of word salad-y thing where he was talking about the auto industry and how it will do so poorly under a Democratic administration. It'll be a bloodbath. And there's been some like kind of stupid consternation about, well, he was talking about the auto industry, not the country at large, which is like, I'm not sure why we're tripping over ourselves to give the benefit of the doubt to someone who pretty clearly has political violence on his mind. You know, in the same speech he said, and he said this before, his first act in office will be pardoning the January 6th quote unquote hostages. Like he opened this event with a rendition of the anthem performed by the people who are in jail. So, you know, but and that's the one that got a lot of the attention, I think, because, you know, bloodbath is evocative and fascisty and all the rest. But just recently, you know, we've also had him say immigrants are not people, you know, doing one of his little riffs about like they're sending us their criminals and their crazy people. He also did a little section or a little post about if Jewish people vote for Democrats, that means they hate Israel. Kind of that was his reaction to the Schumer speech. Just before we came on, there's new stories out about him talking about a 15-week ban. And we talked before about how he was into a 16-week ban because he likes round numbers. But like all these things are pretty gigantic missteps, pretty scary, pretty weird, the kind of stuff that in the past, you know, quote unquote, swing voters or a more moderate general electorate like tends not to love. And we're getting these at a rapid fire right now, kind of mixed into a stew of the increasing, you know, kind of like brain oozy out of the ears mistakes he keeps making. Like I just saw a clip from a recent speech where he kept saying that Biden had run against Obama, you know, so we're getting all this at an increased clip and at in a way that's just already permeating into the kind of media landscape in a way that wasn't for a long time. And I think that has a pretty direct correlation to Trump's, you know, improving poll numbers and favorability ratings, because when he's not in front of you, it's just easy to forget how crazy he is.
It is funny because, you know, in that there was that, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, whenever that was, I guess it was Super Tuesday, maybe when she dropped out, that he's, you know, that there were stories about, you know, that his people say he's pivoting and all this kind of, you know, it's like a cliche and a joke at this point, or like a punchline. But then there were also, I think, which other comments that made up stories from, you know, that that led to stories being written by the people involved in his campaign, where they basically say, oh, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but pretty much capturing exactly what they say, the kind of like, look, he's going to just do whatever he's going to do. There's no controlling him. So we're going to do a kind of like a parallel campaign where we're pivoting and being normal, and we're just going to hope for the best. And kind of, because look, what are you going to do? He's Trump, which is, look, I mean, that's at least, I can't really understand why you're working for Trump, but that's at least a pretty, I think, fair approximation of what it is. And what you read from Dan Pfeiffer is exactly right. There are just, there are these almost kind of algorithms that are kind of, you know, structural dynamics to press coverage that, you know, when he's in a primary and he's saying, oh, the election was stolen and, you know, I'm going to take my enemies and line them up against the wall, you know, reporters kind of look and say, okay, you know, he's running among Republicans. They love that. So that's kind of like saying, I'm going to kiss your baby, or I'm going to have apple pie. Like, what, you know, who cares? It doesn't matter. And then suddenly when you're in a general, it, whatever. And, you know, the thing with the bloodbath remark, I have a few different thoughts about this. One is that I think that, you know, he started talking about the auto industry, but then he kind of just went with it. And then he's talking about, oh, we're also going to have like a total bloodbath. And like, okay, you mean like you're going to kill everybody? You know, so it actually wasn't just kind of like, oh, he was taken out of context. It was a mix. But to me, part of how he operates is that everything he says is just this kind of word salad jumble. And what that makes possible is, you know, you are always having to sort of reconstruct after the fact what he was trying to say. And look, there's a little, you know, there's a little of that with Joe Biden sometimes too, right? The kind of meandering and stuff. But with Biden in that word salad, when it's word salad, the ingredients aren't like, you know, bloodbath, dictator, vengeance. You know, it's kind of like, you know, insulin price going lower, you know, new jobs report. So kind of like you can kind of reconstruct it however you want. But with Trump, it always allows for this kind of like, well, didn't really totally mean that. Kind of it was ambiguous. And like, well, my thought on this whole thing is, and I wrote a post about this. Donald Trump threatens violence and threatens his political opponents, like threatens, like not like I'm going to beat you at the polls, but threatens you. I'm going to put you in jail. I'm going to put the Justice Department on you. There's going to be, you know, blood in the streets. He does that all the time. And he and his supporters have this kind of framework where sometimes when he's riffing in a speech, even his own people goes, all right, that got a little too hot. That was a little spicy for us. And so it's, well, I was kidding. You know, can you, you know, or it was a metaphor. And you're like, you know, dude, I'm not going to litigate every remark. You threaten violence all the time. You say you won't accept election results. You say you're going to throw out the Constitution. You're going to be a dictator. So I'm just going to, that's just who you are. And I'm just going to make clear to everybody that's who you are. And I'm just going to kind of say every time you say things that validate that. And I'm just not going to get into litigating how this one thing that's just, it is something he does. It's the essence of what he does to constantly be throwing stuff out. Just a fugue of incitement and threat. And his targets are constantly reacting. That's so bad. He should take it back. Don't you, that other person, think it's so bad? Donald Trump, do you really mean that? Don't you know you can't do that? Reacting. He acts, everybody else reacts. And that just makes him in charge. And I think people who are his opponents have to kind of think about it at that level. This can't be that he is the one always sort of dictating what we're doing and talking about, because We know who he is. We know who he is. We know what he threatens. We know that he has actually done those things he threatens. So kind of like there's nothing more to discuss. It's just everybody else has to be clear about how bad he is. And hopefully people will listen and he won't get elected again.
Well, and the other piece of this is whenever we hear those pivot stories, it's this idea of, you know, he's going to focus on the stuff that is, you know, his kind of pseudo populism that people like, or, you know, he's going to go all in on immigration, which is traditionally something that, you know, Republicans love and is something more divisive for Democrats. But he's just not more disciplined than he was in 2016. Like, I mean, you've said this before, Josh, but I think there's pretty considerable evidence that he's less disciplined and more inclined to kind of say stuff that his specific rally crowd that will really like, you know, no matter how that'll play with like the swing voters in Pennsylvania he'll need to win the election. And I mean, that is part and parcel with these comments that get a lot of traction because they're weird. You know, I mean, the pardoning the January 6th insurrectionists on the first day, that is not popular. Like, even a majority of self-professed, you know, Trump loving Republicans do not like what the insurrectionists did on January 6th. You know, this is content for the most online, like, groups of kind of MAGA freaks who like go outside of the prison and like call up encouragement to these people. You know, this is like a slice of a slice of a slice of the Republican base. And it's all he can talk about because it gets, you know, big cheers at the by the crowds. You know, this is him kind of going open on where he is on abortion. I mean, and we should be so past the point where there are any valid arguments about, oh, well, a 15-week ban polls well, you know, like people are okay with it. It's like, no, that's just never been true. It's never been about the number of weeks. The American electorate has never, for some bizarre reason, is so weirdly uninformed about pregnancy and the logistics of pregnancy. And we've already had a test case here where like Youngkin and the Virginia Republicans went all in on the 15-week ban, kind of putting all their chips on the table, anticipating that that would be a moderate enough stance that it would kind of thread this needle Republicans have been unable to thread. And they got beat. I mean, they got beat soundly. It doesn't work. People hear the word ban. They don't hear the weeks. I mean, he's talking about a federal ban openly. I mean, that is not popular. So, this is the kind of like campaign Trump that I think we've forgotten about. He's a loose cannon. He doesn't stay on script. He doesn't care about what's politically palatable. He cares about what is going to get him kind of cheers and plaudits from the people directly in front of him. And the people directly in front of him are nearly always his mega fans who are going to like the weird shit and the super online shit that other people don't like. And like, this is why this guy after 2016 has done nothing but lose. Like, he is alienating and he makes normal people feel weirded out and kind of nervous and makes Democrats angry and juiced. And so, you know, I have found these past like couple weeks a little bit settling after we had this extended time where things looked so grim, right? Where it all looked like it was just going to be a referendum on the Biden presidency, and those kind of elections go well for the incumbent like almost never, unless you're in some kind of weird, you know, economic boom time and for whatever other reasons people are feeling good about things. But now Trump is becoming part of the story in a more real way. And like, we're just getting to see up close that he is not a strong candidate. He never has been. And that's not to say that this election won't be a coin toss. I think like all of our presidential elections, maybe forever, are going to be a coin toss. But the narrative of the past few months have just been, you know, Biden's unimaginably weak. Trump's going to wipe the floor with him. And now we're stabilizing back into these dynamics that are kind of familiar to us, which are, you know, Biden might have this stuff to overcome, but he will always and consistently just be favored by the contrast, by the fact that Trump is out of control and maybe more out of control now than he was before. And Biden is just normal.
You know, one thing that Trump said, and he was very candid about, back in 2016, is that the way he gives his speeches is he's tossing things out during the speech, and the things that get people juiced and gunned up, he kind of goes to the sound of the excitement. And he, you know, which is, that's kind of, you know, in a certain amoral, policy-free sense, that makes sense, right? You're market testing. And he did that. And you kind of see him doing that, right? And as we've talked about before, he has become even more like that because I do think he is, his cognition is a little more jumbled than it was 8 years ago. And he's also angrier and more scared than he was. And those things kind of, in a way, they don't fine tune the process. They direct it even more towards aggression. And I mean, it was already pretty directed towards aggression to start with. On the band thing, I think you're totally right, is that we, to a certain extent, because of things that have happened going back decades, but especially because of what has happened in the last 2 or 3 years, people just hear ban. You know, you could almost come in and we're doing a 50-week ban, no abortions before 50 weeks. And I think people would still be, fuck that. We're not doing a ban. 5-0, in case I wasn't clear there or you didn't hear. I actually think, at least, let's put it this way, if it were truly a national 15-week standard, I think it's possible, unfortunately, that a decade ago, you might have actually gotten the political class to get together and say, you know, if in some crazy hypothetical where you could get the pro-life side to say, yep, okay, good, we're going to just shut down now. We're all going to agree 15 weeks and good to go going forward. I think you probably could have, again, I'm not saying it should have happened, but I think it actually would have been possible. But now, after you have Roe go down and bans, and people hear bans. And the other thing, and this is again what I think, I think it's almost inevitable that the campaign will turn heavily on this because he can't not do it. He can't, there's no way Trump is going to go through this election just saying, yeah, this is pretty good. We're good to go. I think my work is done here. That's not going to fly. And I think he realizes that. I mean, he would love to do that. Just say, okay, it's not, you know, not my problem. I'm not involved. What people will quickly realize is it's not a 15-week national standard. It will only apply to blue states because that state of yours that has a 6-week ban or an absolute ban, it doesn't hoist them back up to 15 weeks. It leaves everybody's, it's a limit, right? So it would only actually apply to, you know, New York, California, Massachusetts, you know, blue states. And those, you know, those handful of red states, it was Kansas that had that early vote on it. You know, these handful of red states that still have abortion rights, often because the voters got a bite at the apple, right? So it will quickly be kind of like, or obviously, California doesn't matter since it electorally doesn't matter, right? If you juice the percentage up 10%, California doesn't matter. But Michigan, they just worked really hard to kind of put this whole abortion ban restriction thing to bed. I think that'll kind of, you know, maybe be a problem for Republicans in Michigan. I think so. Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, yeah.
Right.
They're done with this.
As you say, how long until that gets rebranded into the blue state ban, right? Because that's what it is. And you can already tell what a problem it is because Kellyanne Conway was on one of the networks trying to kind of spin it. And she was like, it's not a ban. It's a federal minimum, which is really funny because good luck. I mean, just from a purely like logistical standpoint, good luck getting headline writers to switch from the 3-letter ban to federal minimum. Do you know how much harder that's going to be to fit? But also, even in that, you know, her perfect world of spin, it is a federal minimum, implication being states can go much more maximal with this, right? Like this is just the beginning. It can get worse. I mean, that's just embedded in that term. So yeah, I mean, this is obviously a problem. Like the only place that is safe for Trump on abortion is to say, I personally oppose it. You know, my court sent it back to the states, and that was going to be untenable. And that is kind of reaping what you sow from years of empowering the anti-abortion lobby to be such a huge part of Republican politics. Like, they're not going to be comfortable with that. And, you know, to any degree that they even accept a 15-week ban, which they might, but, you know, it's all going to be in service of moving that Overton window, right? Like, getting a federal ban is a white whale. And even if it's longer than you want, even if at 15 weeks, like, the vast majority of abortions will already have been performed, they would support that, hoping and knowing that if, you know, if Trump gets in with a Republican Congress, that's just the beginning. It'll get scooted back until it's a complete ban on all abortion at any time. More of this scintillating content after these messages.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Back to the show.
It is striking that, and you can see it by Trump's actions, because he, you know, he may be stupid, but he's not dumb, right? He knows that this is bad for him. We've already seen that with, you know, when he's not congratulating himself for overturning Roe, he's saying, the Supreme Court has never been stupider. This was terrible. You know, he kind of can't keep his story straight. And the fact that he is, I mean, he's still trying to kind of slow roll it a bit by saying, yeah, I'm kind of feeling 15. We'll see where, you know, we'll see how it feels when I become president. You know, this kind of, he's trying to fuzz it up a bit, right? To kind of, you know, because he knows it's unpalatable. But what's striking is, I mean, I wouldn't have thought this because I know how the current Republican Party operates, but in some alternative universe, you would have thought, look, they got Roe overturned. I mean, he delivered for them. I mean, he's right. He delivered for them more than they possibly could have imagined. And you would think politically, he comes in and says, you know, I never wanted to, I just wanted to kind of turn it back to the P, as you said, my work is done, but clearly he can't do that. And at the beginning, when a lot of Democrats, for political reasons, want to kind of put that out there, maybe Republicans are going to try to do it nationally, but you don't have to, they don't have to be hyperbolic. Because Republicans do want to do it nationally, because of course they do, because this is what this is their big thing. You know, it's not that all Republicans buy this, but all Republican elected officials in safe districts, they're down the line. This is what they believe. So of course this, you know, it couldn't be any other way.
Right. So Trump has lost or never got one key endorsement of late, which was pretty interesting. And that was Mike Pence on TV saying that, you know, among other reasons, because Trump had, you know, strayed too far from the Constitution, that he would not endorse him. And there was kind of a flurry of reactions to this about, like, well, does it matter? You know, look what happened in Mike Pence's presidential bid. Like, Republicans clearly don't like him, blah, blah, blah. And I actually think that it matters a lot, because I think one of the strongest and easiest cases to make against Trump is very simply basically everyone who worked with him does not want him to be president again. Like, they all think he's crazy. They all think he's out of control. They all think he's dangerous. And, you know, you've got this kind of murderer's row of like old white men who Republicans inherently trust and have been in these circles for forever saying, hey, don't give this guy the nuclear football again. It was really scary the first time. And Pence is just kind of, you know, the face of that, you know, the ad writes itself, right? It's like, it's Mike Pence. It's whatever, 90% of the cabinet. It's his joint chiefs. It's all the military guys, like all these people just smash cut on cut of saying, I will not vote for him. He shouldn't be president again. I can't endorse him, what have you. And in that way, I think the guy who ran as his vice president twice saying, no, I'm not going to endorse him, is like pretty powerful for normal people, even if, you know, the MAGA diehards, you know, wanted him to be hanged on January 6th and would still be fine with that outcome.
Yeah, you know, it's, I think that is right. But even more, I mean, I was going to say, and I am going to say, that I give Mike Pence credit. I hesitate because it is such a low bar. It is such a ridiculously low bar that I feel bad that I am saying it. And yet, you have to put the bar where the bar is, right? And speaking of bar, I actually didn't plan this, but think about Bill Barr, Trump's attorney general. You know, what... another from what in Russia they call the power ministries, you know, DHS, defense, justice. If you're going to be a dictator, you're not doing it with HUD, right? You're not doing it with the EPA. You're doing it with the, where they have guns and jails and stuff. And you have someone like Bill Barr, who now frequently, he doesn't respect the Constitution. He's lawless. What he did was terrible. All these things you hear Bill Barr saying. You know, I'm trying to remember what was during the Jan 6 hearings in 2022. But, you know, you have Liz Cheney saying blah, blah, blah. And Bill Barr's like, yep, he was a lawless tyrant. It was pretty bad. Can't. I was there. I saw it. And then now you say, you know, he was a lawless tyrant, but Joe Biden's tax brackets, they're just a little too high for me. And also, you know, there was a DEI thing. And so I'm back on the Trump train. And, that's I don't even know what that is. Because he didn't have to say that all the things he said about him. You could at least keep it consistent. But he did say those things. And I don't even know what I think. But I know that someone who says both of those things is just totally full of shit and a hypocrite because, you know, I don't think that about Bernie Sanders. But if you're a Republican, maybe you see a Bernie Sanders president and you say, this is, you know, going to shake the foundations of our system and he's a socialist and all this kind of stuff. But you can't say that about Joe Biden. He's like your grandpa. He's just a normal dude. So don't tell me you're afraid of what's going to happen with the country under Joe Biden. You may not like what happens with the country. He may do a lot of things you disagree with, but don't tell me you're afraid, because that's just bullshit. And so with Pence, I don't know. I can't not give him credit, even though it feels ridiculous to give him credit.
Totally. I mean, it's kind of similar to the Nikki Haley thing. Like, was it a profile in courage to kind of, you know, for Pence to not endorse the guy who kind of encouraged people to try to go kill him in the wild? I mean, is it a profile in courage for Nikki Haley to not endorse someone who's been, you know, going after, calling her bird brain and going after her husband who's deployed? Like, no. But normal Republicans not full-throatedly embracing Trump is a big deal. I think it's a big deal from wherever it comes, even if it's corners of the party that just don't have any control over it right now. And I think it's important because it establishes a permission structure for other Republicans to follow in these footsteps instead of the path that McConnell established, which is I'm a Republican, I'm going to get behind the Republican nominee, and that's the end of the conversation. Like, nothing else matters. So I do think it's important that these establishment-y people are saying, no, he's not just a Republican. He is singularly dangerous, and he is not winning the political support that I would give to basically any other Republican candidate in this position. Like, all of that is adding to this big tapestry of Trump is a uniquely dangerous and unfit person. And I think Haley's thing contributed. I think Pence's thing contributes in an even bigger way. And even though these are quite small stands from these people, I think they're important. And this is kind of, I mean, this is the ball game, right? Like, whether or not Biden and whatever Republicans will help can make Trump out to be someone you should fear, like too scary to take a gamble on. That's what's going to turn this election.
Yeah. And the thing for our listeners that I would think about is, you know, one of the things that has made Trump so durable for Republicans is that there's two things that are two sides of the same coin, that if you're a Republican, who is telling you that Trump is not okay? No one. Everybody up there in Congress, they may say, I don't like his Twitter, or oh, he runs a little hot sometimes. But they're all saying, you know, thumbs up, we're good to go here. And the other thing, and again, it's the other side of the same coin, is that he was able to create the reverse of a permission structure within the Republican Party, that if you are a Republican who is against Trump, not just running against him in the way that Tim Scott did, but against Trump, you're not really a Republican. And he was able to shift the definition. And that is a definition that, frankly, most of us buy into now because he has made it true. Right. If you are a Republican who is against Trump, you're not really a Republican, because that's what the Republican Party is now. So he creates this thing where, as I said, if you're a Republican, there's no Republican saying, hey, this isn't a good idea. And if there are, they cease to become Republicans. Because when you have someone like that, a John Kasich or a Adam Kinzinger or whoever else, a Liz Cheney, you know, they're going to show up on MSNBC pretty soon. And like probably have their own show. And I'm not mocking them. I'm not making fun of that. I'm just explaining that that is the dynamic. And that dynamic can work as long as it is a few people, right? But if it becomes a little more than a few people, that structure becomes a little less stable. Because you're saying, well, okay, Mike Pence, he's pretty Republican. Yeah. And like Nikki Haley, she's pretty Republican. She was just running, and she's not an MSNBC. So it may happen to them too. And we have, again, in a way, we've all sort of bought into this, that Democrats and everybody who's rightly opposes Donald Trump say to other Republicans, you know, come on over, dude. You know, you can still be whatever that crazy Republican stuff you believe in. Fine. Let's just all be a team and say no to this guy. And that's exactly what we should be doing. But again, there's this kind of, it's sort of like, you know, when you see a top spinning, and then if you touch it, it'll kind of get all wiggly and weird and then spin off. When there's a few more people, that kind of like fine line, just a few more than one or two, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, that unanimity among Republicans gets a little fidgety. And remember, that's what happened after January 6th, because a lot of Republicans stood up and said, okay, fuck that. That's too much. And everything kind of changed. And then about a week later, they all got back on board again. So we have to watch and see how that develops, because it's certainly not, look, it's, we all know this election isn't going to end with like everybody saying, wow, Trump was a crazy dude and he got 10%. Of course not. But we also know all these elections, as Kate said, are a close run thing. So, you know, a few percentage points makes all the difference.
Totally. So the last thing we're going to talk about is a little more, you know, foreign affairs-y. This is the newest advancements on, you know, the home front in regard to Israel-Gaza. Last week, you know, Schumer gave this big speech where he called for new elections in Israel. Josh wrote a piece about it. really big deal. Schumer is the highest ranking Jewish official in American politics. He's long been a staunch supporter of Israel and of Netanyahu, even at a time when a lot of other Democrats were pretty pissed at him. You know, this is back during the Obama era, kind of famous unauthorized joint speech conundrum. And that's had some fallout. That's what prompted Trump to do the whole, Jews hate Israel if they vote for Democrats thing. He's gotten some blowback from, various Jewish organizations. But what I think was really politically adroit about that was it kind of conclusively subbed in Netanyahu rather than the concept of Israel, which, as we've discussed on the show before, is a lot more divisive for Democrats, especially along generational divides. And it's just an easier target, I think, if Biden is kind of criticizing Netanyahu rather than Israel writ large, because Netanyahu is way less popular. He's hemorrhaged popularity within Israel itself. Democrats have long disliked the guy, mostly because he kind of stabs them in the back and aligns himself with Republicans whenever he gets the chance. And now Republicans are kind of solidifying that dynamic where it's Democrats versus this very unpopular world leader who is pretty visibly knows that his career is over when the war is, right? Senate Republicans invited Netanyahu to address their retreat. That fell through. But today, Wednesday, he's supposed to zoom in and address them at their little weekly lunch. So, imagine them kind of spooning up Jell-O while they listen to him talk to them. And now House Republicans, kind of loath to miss out on this, are discussing, inviting him to talk to them. Josh, you flagged offline before we started recording that there is mutterings about bringing him in to do an unauthorized joint address to Congress part two, which, as you noted, they seem to have forgotten that they don't control the Senate anymore. So that might be a little trickier to do. But this is all the past kind of couple weeks has been really headlined by Democrats making Netanyahu the thing, not Israel in theory, but Netanyahu, and Republicans kind of happily being like, okay, sweet, then we'll be team Netanyahu, we'll be his boys, and this is a bit of a carryover from, as we say, this goes back a while, but particularly during Trump, there was real coziness with Netanyahu there, Netanyahu named a new development in the Golan Heights. He named it Trump Heights to kind of thank him for Trump, endorsing that kind of their
Abraham
autonomy
Accords.
Over the land. Exactly.
Right.
And yeah, moving, moving the embassy to Jerusalem and all of this very hand in hand stuff, even though Trump has been a little pissier at Netanyahu ever since 2020. Cause I think Netanyahu said something really kind of anodyne about the election, but Trump, this was still the point where Trump was trying to overturn it. And so he took that as a big, a disloyalty thing. And
he also, tried to be the first foreign leader to call and have a chat with Biden. Because when Trump lost, Netanyahu knew that he was
dead in the water.
that was going to be a problem for him. So he's trying to kind of kiss up and everything. But obviously Trump thought hey, you're my boy. We're stopping this deal here. So he got kind of pissy at Netanyahu. But anyway, go on. I know you were your point.
This is kind of the wrap up, but this is where we are now, that the alignment is starting to break a little bit less about who likes Israel and who likes Palestine, which is a really uncomfortable place for Democrats to be. And now it's increasingly kind of becoming who likes Netanyahu and who doesn't, which is way easier for Democrats and something that they are gonna sing from the same song sheet about.
It's funny because it is, in a way, it's one of these things where both parties, factions in the U.S. may find this comfortable for them, right? Mm-hmm. I think it could hurt Republicans, but certainly, as we know, this has been a big problem for Joe Biden. And what I think a lot of the left of the Democratic Party, to a different extent, Arab Americans and Muslim Americans. What I think people miss is that I have seen a lot of people on the left of the Democratic Party treat this as politically, this is just obvious. You're throwing your election away because of your support for Israel. And why are you doing that? It's just obvious. Now, I don't think, but it's not, because there are very big factions on both sides of this in the Democratic Party. So when I said less so about Arab Americans and Muslim Americans, I think Arab Americans who feel passionate about this, they're like, I don't give a fuck about whatever other faction you need to worry about. This is my issue. Muslim Americans to, you know, a comparable extent. And I'm certainly not saying it's only Arab Americans and Muslim Americans, I'm just saying that the nature of this slightly different thing, which is, it's one thing to say Joe Biden has done something that is unacceptable to me, so, you know, I'm out. I'm not going to vote for him. I'm not going to do this. It's a different thing to say, why are you being so stupid? There's the political choice here is obvious. Just do it. It's not obvious. The political dynamics are not that simple. And so even if you want him to have a very different policy, again, the politics are very complicated and tricky. And so, as you said, Kate, this gives him some distance in a way that does not challenge America's basic support for Israel in a kind of a comprehensive sense. It's also given him the ability to say, we have Israel's back, but you got to get some food in there. This is unacceptable. And I think a lot of people ignore this for a long time, with the administration saying in Rafah, and just to give you context, because I'm sure people hear about this place Rafah, and what's the big deal? Why is this different and everything? Basically, a big part of the population in the rest of the Gaza Strip, in the north of the Gaza Strip, in the middle, Rafah is a city that is down right on the Egyptian border, the southern border of the Gaza Strip. And as this horrific violence has been taking place in the rest, a huge percentage of the population relocated down to this one city. So you've got just the people who normally live there, plus like, you know, half the rest of the population of the whole territory that are in this one place. And what the Biden administration has been saying very clearly is, we know why you want to, because basically the rest of Hamas's brigades are there too. That's where they're holding out. That's their kind of last stand. So it is understandable in military terms why the Israelis say, hey, our whole thing here was to kind of destroy Hamas's army. That's where they're kind of holding out. So we need to go in there. And the Biden administration has said, you can't do what you've been doing in the rest of the territory down there. You're not going to do it the same way. And that's kind of where things are. So it has, in political terms, allowed Biden to get some distance, which I don't think he just wants for political terms. I think it's in policy terms what he wants too, and kind of has from the beginning. And it's been tricky for them on a number of levels. There's an element of this that is, there's part of this that is, I wouldn't say it's dishonest. It's a little incomplete, in the sense that in Israel, it is absolutely not the case that like this Netanyahu guy wanted to do this war in Gaza thing, and everybody else was like, why are you doing this? This is crazy. That's not remotely the case. The support for the retaliation and the effort to destroy Hamas in Gaza has had very wide, you know, broad support in Israel. You know, you get into specifics and hostage, you know, it gets more complicated. But it is certainly not the case that this is just Netanyahu's war, not remotely. But there are different dimensions of it. What happens after the war? How, you know, what are you doing to make sure the civilian population has food? Blah, 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 blah. It gets much more complicated in terms of the politics within Israel. And as Kate said, it is still the case. Netanyahu, his popularity cratered the day those attacks happened back on October 7th, and it has never recovered. That has not changed. So this has given Biden and Democrats some important distance. And I think what you've also seen is that now Republicans are saying, yeah, let us get in on that Netanyahu stuff. And now Trump is back saying, like, you know, kind of like, yeah, they got to finish the business in Gaza. So at least you're having a little more reality about the political context in the United States. That kind of like, because for you know, you were saying, Kate, how on abortion and all these different kind of things, the dynamics of the primary campaign were letting Trump just kind of ignore a lot of these issues. And you even had some people say, well, you know, kind of like that notorious column, Maureen Dowd column back in 2016, like, you know, Trump the dove, Hillary mm-hmm. the hawk. Right. This idea like, well, he's sort of a Trump, sort of, you know, a two-state man. I mean, dude, he's Trump. So Biden and the Democrats have, this is still a very, very difficult political and policy issue. But I think that the whole thing is in a more realistic place than it was a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally
agree.
That's
how I put it. So,
all right.
That's it. We covered a lot of territory there. Remember our membership drive. It really is important. And again, it's kind of what I said, is that you can inspire our TPM gang here, right? The people who actually put this out, because it is great if our well-being as an organization just is totally about our relationship with you guys. Then we don't have to worry about Google or Facebook or Elon Musk or, you know, the private equity guys who are buying up all the publications and shutting them down the next day. None of that matters. We're kind of like totally insulated and just, we're just dealing with you guys. And that's a great place for us to be. And I hope it's a great place for you to be, because it's your opinions that matter. And that's just a good thing all around. So if you're not a member, please consider joining. And I'll just leave it at that. Again, if you're someone who doesn't go to the website a lot, it is talkingpointsmemo.com. Talkingpointsmemo.com, just the three words run together.com. And you just go to the site and believe me, you will see stuff about our drive, and it's really easy to sign up, and it's worth it. And it is also for a good cause and all that good stuff. And I think that is all we have for this week. Is that it?
That's it. See you
all
next
right.
week.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.